This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, if you're an NPR junkie, then you will be very familiar with the work of my guest today. Tamara Keith has been covering the White House since 2014, and in that time, she's reported on the Obamas, spent countless hours on the campaign trail with Hillary Clinton, and recently traveled on a surprise trip to Iraq with Donald Trump. She's also the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast, where the tone is less formal, but the content is just as juicy. She puts Trump's early morning Twitter storms in context, if that is possible, and she also tracks the large political events of the day. And Tamara Keith joins me now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
So great to be here.
I want to get a kind of a broad sweep now, because you start in 2014, Barack Obama's the president. It is now 2019. There's another president in the office. How have things changed in terms of for a reporter covering the White House?
Yeah, so President Obama, when I started covering him, was at the end of his presidency and sort of a lame duck, kind of boring. He was doing what he called his pin and phone strategy, which was that he was, because he couldn't get Congress to do anything, he was done. And so he was signing executive orders and taking other executive action. And he was using his phone to convene people to have conversations about issues he cared about. So, it was sort of like, okay, you're coming into the finish. And then President Trump came in and he took all the oxygen, right? Like, he was not boring and he is still not boring. He is a person who consumes all of the energy, all of the attention. Everything's constantly changing. He, however, is also using a pen and phone strategy, which is sort of remarkable given that he's not a lame duck. And he was using this pen and phone strategy from the very beginning, going in and doing a ton of executive orders, and not trying to get most of what he was trying to do. He wasn't trying to get through Congress, and he did a remarkable number of things through executive action. Also, a remarkable number of things through executive action got held up in court.
Right. But a lot of that is because that's what's going on inside of his head and
yeah.
What he wants to see. And this whole democratic process is just a bit of a nuisance, it seems, because of the number of executive orders. But the convening part, that would be if I would be surprised to know that he's got issues that matter a lot to him and he would like to hear from other experts and really be informed because he's the president. You can imagine Barack Obama saying, wow, I'm the president. I can call some of the smartest people in the country and ask them about this stuff that's been bugging me for years. Donald Trump did that.
He has people who arrange for listening sessions, and there are these things that are convened at the White House. One thing that he really does care about is the opioid epidemic, and he has heard from a lot of different voices on that. I mean, you're right that by and large, he's not persuadable. He is someone who makes up his mind about something or made up his mind about something in 1982, and he has not moved from that view or that position. Take China. He has believed that China is eating our lunch since the 80s or maybe since the 90s. Back in the 80s, he thought it was Japan that was eating our lunch. But with tariffs, like, everyone around him will say tariffs are not just taking money from the other country. Tariffs are a tax on American consumers by way of American companies. It's passed on to consumers. It is a tax on Americans. Any Republican in Congress will tell you that. Economic advisors to the president will tell you that. He does not believe that, or he certainly won't accept that publicly. It's a very different approach.
The other thing that has to have changed is certainly the number of briefings we've seen. The press briefings are now down to practically zero. And I don't know that does that matter, because those are sort of staged events anyway. How much does that matter to a reporter?
That is a difficult question. In a lot of ways. So it's been more than 90 days since the last formal White House press briefing held by the press secretary. That is problematic. Obviously, it makes it very hard, especially for smaller outlets, to get their questions answered. And for those of us in broadcast, sometimes you want an answer on tape and you can't get it this way right. without a briefing. Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, has been having briefings out in the driveway. They aren't briefings. They're gaggles. They're kind of like drive-bys in the driveway. And it's not...
Is she in her car? I mean, just leaning out the window saying, you were still against...
No.
We want more tariffs.
No, I mean, she basically, she goes on Fox. She does a friendly interview on Fox. Mm-hmm. She walks. She has to walk from the camera back to her office at the White House. Meanwhile, everyone knows she's been on Fox, and we all clump together out in the driveway and try to get her to answer questions. And she is in the power position that way.
Right.
She, you know, in a briefing, she would call on a reporter. She doesn't know what that reporter's going to ask. In the driveway, everybody's shouting questions, and she answers what she wants to answer. Mm. And also, it creates this perception of the press and the press corps as this unruly mob of people out to get the administration because, well, you know, we're kind of unruly because we're out in a driveway shouting over, you know, airplanes. So it is problematic. But let me also say that given that there has not been solidly good information coming out of those briefings, given that, you know, the Mueller report shows that Sarah Sanders readily admitted under oath that she did not tell the truth about something in a press briefing, and we know that wasn't the only instance, then how valuable is it? It's not as valuable as it used to be because the press secretary used to speak for both the president, which no one can speak for President Trump, and they also used to speak for the American people and the American government. They were the voice of America to not just America, but to the world by way of this briefing, and that doesn't exist anymore.
Right. I mean, that was their way of getting out. But now that if you're on Twitter at 4 o'clock in the morning, you really don't need a press briefing anymore to get the word out in some ways, in a formal way. Let me talk about the times, though, that you still have an intermediary in Sarah Sanders, who's going to be the press secretary, and that's who you're dealing with in the briefings. And then there are these moments where you can really be alone, more or less, with the president himself for hours, and that would be on Air Force One. What's that like?
Air Force One is as impressive as it seems. You know, the White House press briefing room is actually kind of small and kind of dingy and not that hot. Air Force One is amazing. I mean, it is this giant representation of American power and influence in the world. We are pretty well separated from the president on Air Force One. Yeah. 13 members of the press pool fly on Air Force One wherever the president goes. We're in the way back by the kitchen that makes really lovely food. They get their ingredients from Costco and Wegmans. And
there are
a couple of different compartments ahead of us before you get to where the president is. But sometimes he pops back and talks. Sometimes it's off the record. Most of the time it's off the record. Yeah. Sometimes it's on the record. Sometimes he wants to call us up. I was flying with him to a rally on the day that Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed and sworn in. And he called us up to the front to watch Fox with him as he saw the final vote tally come in.
All right. So what's he like when, you know, sort of you're on the plane together and he's off the record? Is he the same as his public persona? Or does that let down at all, change?
It's slightly different. He's more chummy with the reporters. I mean, the reality is that, I wouldn't say we're all like slapping on the back, happy on the plane. But the reality is you can see hints of it in press conferences where he's like, hey, you, or I saw you the other day, or like, it's the same sort of thing where there are journalists who he knows from television or knows from their byline in The New York Times, and he is more interested in talking to them or seeking approval even.
Yeah, the president seeking approval, that's a thing that's important to him. Let me ask you about politics now, because you also covered Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016, and I wonder what lessons you learned from that.
What lessons I learned in particular about my reporting is just that there were a lot of things that I saw, a lot of warning signs or, you know, dead canaries lying on the ground, that I simply didn't have time to report out, in part because I was on the plane all the time and we were running from place to place to place to place. And I think that certainly my goal in covering the election this cycle is to try to slow down, to try to stay places a little bit longer, to listen to my instincts just a little bit more.
Let me, instincts about the campaign itself. This is not going as well as the polls are showing or something like that.
Right. Or the campaign said, you know, the computer geniuses at the campaign said to do a rally right in this place because this would be the place that they need to get to win Florida. And then the rally is kind of a disaster and there are more protesters than there are supporters. Like, if we hadn't been flying to the next stop in Florida, I probably would have paused and said, huh, maybe those geniuses aren't so genius after all.
Very quickly, and I've got about 30 seconds left with the Politics Podcast interviewing 2020 Democratic candidates. There are 1,700 of them. How are you going to do it?
We do just count 23. So far, we've done 4 interviews. We have another one that has been completed and is about to post. We are trying to introduce our audience, and our podcast audience tends to be a little bit younger, but also very politically engaged. Yeah. We're trying to introduce them to these candidates, asking policy questions, but also asking personal questions. And then our podcast always ends with something called Can't Let It Go, where you talk about one thing you can't stop thinking about, politics or otherwise. And we're trying to get them to talk about something that they can't let go of that's otherwise not politics.
Tamara Keith, White House correspondent for NPR, co-host of NPR's Politics Podcast. And of course, you can find links to her reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Tamara, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So great to be with you. Thank you.
Coming up on the State of Things, we're going to talk about the impact of Donald Trump's immigration policies as we head to Western North Carolina and hear one woman's story. Stay tuned to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.